Next, I want to speak to the idea of communism and the reality of revolution to get to communism and some of the contradictions that are actually involved and bound up with this. To once again invoke a phrase from the poet T.S. Eliot, between the idea and the reality falls the shadow. This is a way, when applied to what we're talking about, to express the profound and often acute contradictions between where we're aiming to go and what we have to get through to get there. Now, as a very brief aside, I can't resist saying a few words about T.S. Eliot, since I like to quote him sometimes. He is not historically a positive figure. In fact, his alienation, which was a striking feature of his poetry, as expressed in his poems with titles like The Wasteland, and even in very evocative openings of poems like the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, which begins, "Let us go then, you and I, while the evening is spread out across the sky like a patient etherized upon a table." Even very evocative language like that was in the service of a great deal of reactionary alienation. But an interesting thing, and which reflects the contradictoriness of reality, is that in the early 60s in particular, but as part of the whole quote-unquote 60s generation, and for the intellectuals of that generation in particular, T.S. Eliot was often and broadly quite popular because this alienation resonated with a very different kind of alienation that many of the youth of that time, particularly not only coming out of the middle class, were feeling in the context of a very repressive and suffocating culture in American society, and in the context of what they could begin to see America doing in the world as well as within its own country. So it's kind of an acutely contradictory phenomenon that you know, people like Mario Savio, for example, and myself as well, were very drawn to a lot of the poetry of T.S. Eliot at a certain point because it expressed a certain alienation with which on a certain level you could identify. But then if you go more deeply, you see this alienation was of a reactionary and expressly reactionary character. And it was prompted to a significant degree not only by World War I in a general sense and all the horrors that, you know, and destruction and slaughter that occurred as a result of it in the course of that war. T.S. Eliot was someone who was born in the U.S. but moved to England because he more identified with English society and became an English citizen. And it was not only the general events of World War I and all the slaughter and destruction, but also in a real sense the weakening of Britain through the course of that war. You know, it used to be, "Rule Britannia, Britannia rule the waves. Britons never, never, never shall be slaves." But unfortunately, Britannia didn't rule nearly as much of the waves after World War I and therefore didn't have anything like the colonial empire it did. And you had all the even those who survived, the wounded veterans of the war, walking around London with their limbs shot off and everything. And all this combined to in people like T.S. Eliot, to give expression to a very pessimistic and even reactionary alienation, certain sense of loss of purpose that purpose had been associated with what England had been, especially in the minds of many devoted to the British Empire, not just the English culture. And Eliot's alienation was an alienation that was specifically looking to the past and explicitly looking to the past. He described himself after a certain point as a royalist politically, in other words, a supporter of the monarchy, and a religious traditionalist in terms of his ideological or philosophical outlook. Nonetheless, with all that and coming back from that detour, there is some value to posing it in the terms of that line from T.S. Eliot, "Between the idea and the reality falls the shadow," which does speak to the, sometimes, as I said, acute contradiction between where it is we're setting out to go and what we have to go through to get there. So here, between the idea and the reality in this sense, is where many see the problem, even many seeking a radical alternative. And here, in fact, is a real, profound, and at times very acute historical contradiction between the vision and the actual governing principles of communist society, and once again, what is required in order to reach that. If we could somehow just leap in a single bound straight to communism, many more people would be willing to take the leap if you could show you could do it that way. Many people are attracted to the idea, or the ideal, as they actually envision it, of communism in a general and somewhat abstract sense. Economically, the idea that there would be an abundance for all and that the principle of each according to their ability, to each according to their needs, could be applied, and that there'd be plenty to go around so that no one would be in need and people would not be scrambling and scuffling in competition with each other to meet either basic needs or broader needs. That's a very appealing and attractive idea to many people, especially, of course, those seeking a radical alternative. And politically, and in terms of ideology, the idea that the political system, such as it would be serving these kind of principles, and that ideologically people would be motivated by the idea of these kinds of relations, is attractive if you can divorce it from all the real world and acute contradictions that are involved in getting there and then in dealing with it once you are there. So if we could just somehow leap in a single bound straight to communism and eliminate all the contradictions in getting there and even the contradictions that would be there when we got there, well, then it would be easy to attract a lot more people to it. But we can't do that. Once again, this is scientific communism, not utopianism, that's involved. And this leads to two points that I want to focus some attention on. First, what is involved in making revolution to overthrow the old order and establish a new society and a new state? Or to put it another way, the essential question of state power. And again, as I've spoken to it before, what state power is good for? In order to actually make the first great leap on the road to communism, that is to overthrow the existing system, and the existing state power as a concentration of the relations of that system requires a monumental struggle. And let us be honest, monumental sacrifice and monumental chaos and upheaval on a mass scale. And yes, destruction. Mainly not initiated or brought about by the forces of revolution, but by the forces of the old order. And in order to have a revolution, there has to be a group in society, to put it in certain terms, for whom life is a living hell already anyway. And at the same time, a group in society that can gravitate toward the idea and toward the reality of a struggle to bring into being a society in which the collective interest of the people is put above individual and particular interests, even while individual and particular interests are protected and safeguarded in a whole new context and with a whole new and radically different and better meaning. And here's another contradiction we face. On the one hand, we cannot write off, treat as if they're in the camp of the enemy and thereby serve to drive them into the camp of the enemy, all those people whose position in society and in the world does not drive them toward a desperate search for a radical alternative, who may be deeply disaffected and even angry about the direction of things, but whose daily life is not such that they don't recoil from the idea of upheaval and turmoil and even sacrifice and even destruction. That goes back to the soft in the middle point about the U.S. There's a very broad array of people in the society who fall into that category. And beneath them, there are other people to whom we have to dig down, as Lenin said, lower and deeper. People who are not only impoverished, but in particular people who are proletarians, whose outlook is one of or gravitates toward striving not just to fight back against injustice and oppression that they suffer in a more direct sense, but toward bringing into being a whole world in which all of the oppressive and exploitative relations would be abolished and superseded by something far better. And that doesn't mean they spontaneously understand the need for that and are advocating that already without us. It means that their position in society and the way they're driven by life and their position within the dynamics of society makes them more readily inclined to gravitate toward that and to take up that position. You are never going to have a revolution without a social base of people, a large and significant and strategically based group in society, a class and those closely aligned with it in their position in society and in their fundamental interests, for whom revolution really is the only way out of a daily existence and reality that constitutes, in fact, a horror, however much they may make their way through it one way or another from day to day, so long as that's what they're forced to do. Now, in the world as a whole, but also in the U.S. in particular, there is such a force. We face a difficult configuration in the U.S. because of this big soft middle, quote unquote. But first of all, there is a class and a force in society that does correspond to that position to which I've been speaking. And second of all, there is a basis, particularly through the course of bringing forward a revolution and a revolutionary struggle based among that fundamental base, there is a means and a basis to win over broad sections of that middle. Of course, that's full of acute contradiction as well. But the dialectics of this have to be understood, and we have to, in a certain sense, to use that phrase, master these dialectics. The dialectics are such that if you simply seek to go to the most bedrock base for revolution in this country, and not even if you don't write off, but if you simply ignore political work among or the concerns of these broader strata, you will not develop a revolutionary movement in general, and more specifically, you will not actually bring forward the revolutionary potential of that basic bedrock force, because they will not and cannot act in a situation in which they perceive themselves to be or in reality are surrounded by a force which is hostile or even at best indifferent to their striving for a radically different world. On the other side of the dialectic, you will never influence broad numbers of people among the middle strata in the direction of revolution except as you are increasingly bringing forward a revolutionary force from the base of society in the way that I've spoken to it. So you can have a negative dialectic or dynamic going where you can't get because you ain't got. But we have to master the positive grasp of the dialectics, to put it that way, in order to combine all positive factors and to actually get the right synthesis where we're able increasingly, with the development of the objective situation and with our working on the objective situation through hastening while awaiting, to increasingly get that positive synergy, to use that phrase, that positive back and forth in which this core revolutionary force is brought forward as the backbone and basic driving force of the revolution. But increasingly, it is being nurtured by the resistance that's developing among these other strata, and they in turn are being influenced in a revolutionary, more and more revolutionary direction by what is coming forward from beneath them in a positive sense. There's no other way that you could even conceive of, let alone actually develop in reality, a revolutionary movement which have any kind of a chance of going up against the powerful, entrenched system that we are, in fact, up against. And again, to invoke that line from Bob Dylan, the hour is getting late, so let us not talk falsely now. Let us look at the actual reality and grasp and learn to master correctly the actual dialectics of getting the, if you will, the positive reinforcement between of the back and forth between work among these different groups within society, all guided by a strategic aim of where this all needs to go, which in turn is rooted in a grasp of many of the things that I've been emphasizing in terms of the fundamental contradiction underlying and giving rise to the driving dynamics in all this. Only if you step back in a certain sense, only if you get to that mountaintop, only if you have that quote-unquote godlike position of the proletariat, could you actually see the possibility of this, let alone actually bring into being the reality of it. Viewed narrowly from within any particular aspect of this, even viewed narrowly from within the base of standing at the lower, deeper sections of the proletariat and viewing the world simply through that prism is too narrow. You will not be able to see the possibility. Spontaneously, the masses don't see it themselves who were in that position, partly because of the workings of the system, including the molding of public opinion, but also because on their own and without a scientific view and without a strategic, quote-unquote, godlike vista, they can't see the possibility of a way out. The perspective is too narrow from viewed simply within the position of any section, even the most lower, the lowest and deepest sections of the proletariat. The vista, the perspective is too narrow. This is Lenin's point in what is to be done, come at from a different angle, that this has to be brought from without. It has to be brought in the terms of it being systematized into a conscious scientific approach to understanding and transforming reality and then brought to the masses and taken up by them. There are all kinds of profound and acute contradictions involved in that process, including what many people grab hold of to attack the whole project, which is that in the very fact that this has to be brought from without, there is a contradiction that those who first take up this conscious approach and scientific outlook and methodology generally come from among a small percentage of the population and predominantly from among the intellectuals to begin with. And there's first the question of can a leap be made to where this becomes taken up broadly and increasing layers of the masses? If not, you get nowhere near a revolution. You merely have intellectual discussions, which may be valuable, which may be fruitful, but in and of themselves, as important as they may be, will never lead to a revolution. So that's one contradiction and one leap. But then after you've made that, or if you make that, there's another leap, which is much more broad, sweeping, and historical, which is that even if you mobilize masses and a section of the masses comes forward to form the backbone of the vanguard, you have still not eliminated the contradiction between those who do intellectual work and those who do physical work, between mental and manual labor, however you want to formulate it, and between those who are accustomed to working in the realm of ideas and the broad masses of people. You cannot overcome that until you get into the socialist stage, until you overthrow the system again and begin moving through the socialist transition as part of the whole world revolution toward communism. So you're making a revolution full of contradictions, not only all the physical dimension of struggle, sacrifice, upheaval, violence, chaos, and destruction, largely brought about by the forces of the old order, but which you have to meet and defeat, but also the contradiction that you carried like a germ within what you're doing, that those who are leading it in the necessary first great leap of seizing power are not those who by themselves can carry out the transformation that's required. And unless the broader ranks of the masses are brought into this and you handle correctly all the acute contradictions of doing that while not suffocating intellectual life and cultural life and any vibrancy and vitality in society, unless you handle that and you move beyond these kind of divisions, your revolution will get turned around at one point or another. This is a germ or a cell within the revolution. It's acutely contradictory. This is something we've learned more deeply and sharply through the experience of socialist society so far. What we're doing here has to be done in one form or another. It has to be replicated in the thousands and millions in socialist society, and that can't be done overnight. And what I'm doing here has to become, along the way, unnecessary in essential terms. And yet it remains very necessary for a long time. This is another acute expression of the underlying contradictions that are involved. And there's no easy solution to this. And people who have fallen into attempts at easy solutions through a combination of nationalism, dogmatism, and so on, lop off the heads of the intellectuals, smash anybody who wears glasses, etc., etc., or on the other side, give absolutely free rein to everybody and see where it all goes. Well, where it's all gone in one form or another is back to the old order and back to the old society, and it's even more demoralizing because it looks like what we're trying to bring into being just can't work. So these are the acute contradictions that you get right down on the ground with these things. There's not going to be any revolution made unless the masses of people in the inner cities and in the sweatshops and in the farm fields and so on take up this revolutionary outlook and struggle not in a blind way but consciously to understand reality and transform it. On the other hand, the difference between them and those who have more facility to begin with because of life experience, because of anything genetic or anything about them in particular, but nevertheless because of life experience, have more facility in working with all these ideas, that contradiction is going to remain and sometimes be quite acute, and it's going to reproduce itself. Because you get, for example, to socialism, and people who have been locked out of all this, the doors are open to their getting involved in it, but you don't overcome the contradictions all at once. So some sections of people who've been impoverished, who've been denied any access to this whole sphere of working with ideas, find it open to them. And from an early age, they're encouraged and nurtured and trained and developed to do this. But it doesn't happen with everybody all at once because of the necessities of life and of transforming society. People have to eat. You have to have ability to defend the revolution that you've made. You have to be able to find the correct relationship to the rest of the world and even trading with some of the rest of the world. And all these contradictions assert themselves and prevent you from overcoming these deep-seated contradictions or this germ that you're carrying forward within your own revolutionary process, keep you from overcoming that all at once. So we've learned more deeply that these are the acute and critical contradictions that we're going to have to be dealing with correctly. And we've made mistakes now in one direction and now in the other, and sometimes bouncing from one to the other. Mistakes in the direction of treating the people who have had more privileged position as virtually, if not literally, as the enemy. Or mistakes, on the other hand, of giving too free a rein, not only to them, but to others who come forward who objectively occupy a more privileged position even in socialist society. In the Soviet Union, a lot of the engineers and people who have had positions of leadership in industry and so on came out of the working class. But once they got into those positions, they were different than the broad mass of people even out of which they had come. And you can't get rid of those contradictions right away. So this is one whole focus of struggle and one whole concentration or expression of contradictions that has to be dealt with. We can't just go like that and get to communism. We have to work our way through all these contradictions and do it correctly. And you don't even have a chance of doing that if you don't continue to more and more deeply ground yourself in materialism and dialectics and the whole method and approach that flows from that. These are some of the key lessons that we've drawn from the first stage of proletarian revolution and socialist society. Especially with regard to dictatorship and democracy, but also all the contradictions, some of which I've just spoken to, including the contradiction between mental and manual labor, which are involved in moving beyond, ultimately, beyond the sphere of bourgeois right, in both the economic base, but also in the superstructure, in the sphere of politics, in the sphere of influence over the direction of society, in the sphere of ideas. How do you actually get and apply the correct synthesis on this? The more that you think about this, besides getting a headache, the more you will understand why I have repeatedly made this, invoked this metaphor of being drawn and quartered, which, you know, means like a punishment in ancient feudal society. They would tie a horse to each limb of the person and then have the horses go in four directions, literally pulling the body apart like that. This is the metaphor I'm invoking for what it will be like if you are correctly approaching the handling of these contradictions. Because if you want a society in which people are debating affairs of state and world affairs, this is, you know, people have pointed this out, you know, in talking about this solid core of the elasticity. Think about it. You want that kind of debate, so all of a sudden people are debating whether your foreign policy of your government should be what it is. And in so doing, they're talking about all kinds of sensitive things. And we need maturity, by the way. Right now, not only in the socialist age, you need maturity, you know, to understand what you're dealing with. You're dealing with an enemy out there. When you have state power, you're dealing with a powerful enemy that's looking to pounce on you. As much as these people talk about the free marketplace of ideas, believe me, they don't believe in it. There has never been an instance where the massive people have been led by communists, rose up and attempted to make revolution, and the bourgeoisie has said, well, let's see if it works. They claim they can make a better society. Let's stand back, get out of their way, and see if they can actually do it, and then we'll compare it to ours and see which one people like. Now, apparently, when Raymond Lotta spoke at UCLA, the Republican neo-fascists or whatever they are were reduced to whining in those terms. When they tried to make their arguments and they were countered powerfully, they said, well, why can't we just sort of go do our capitalist thing and you go do your communist thing and we'll see which one comes out better. But that was a momentary lapse on their part. That's not how the bourgeoisie relates to what we're trying to do. They will pounce on it, look for weaknesses, play on those weaknesses, try to develop and heighten those weaknesses and those contradictions that we're having to deal with in a negative way, and they will move as soon as they can in various ways militarily, not only try to strangle you economically and try to isolate you diplomatically and politically, but leap on you militarily. So you need maturity and sophistication, and we need it now too. Let me say that there are real sharks in the water right now. We are trying to do big things in the world. We talk in terms of this regime and what it represents and some unprecedented things that it's striving for with its grand strategy and these, you know, aims it has in the world, wild ambitions it has in the world. And we talk about how as part of this is a whole intensification of the more open repressive expression of bourgeois dictatorship. And do you think that these people are just going to sit back and say, well, here's this movement coming along saying the world can't wait, drive out the Bush regime, let's see how they do with it? If you fall into thinking that, you're not being serious. They're going to send people in to try to disrupt it, to try to discredit it, to try to raise ideas in the context of it, which they can use to then come after it. And here again you see the drawn and quartered point. Because if you don't know how to apply the correct methodology in dealing with this, you're either going to fall into allowing yourself to be easily set up without even recognizing what's happening to you, or you're going to fall into creating an atmosphere of suspicion and paranoia which will destroy what you're trying to do from the inside, so to speak. And handling contradictions like that now are both extremely and strategically important, and they also bear on developing the ability to lead the whole complex process of revolution and then the even more complex process of socialist transition once you've made the first great leap to seize power. So we need right now a much greater awareness of what we're dealing with. We don't need a dualism of one hand talking bad shit about these people and then acting like they're not really what we say they are. And when we get to socialist society, all this will be greatly magnified. That's why I do keep invoking this metaphor of being drawn and quartered. You want this kind of political ferment and intellectual ferment? Well, people are not only going to disagree with you, but they're going to verge on, if not literally, revealing state secrets, which can do a lot of damage. How do you handle it? How do you sort all that out? How do you do that? How do you prevent strategic damage from being done without turning the lights out and making everything suffocating and making everyone intimidated and afraid to raise their head, let alone to voice any objections, disagreement, or mobilize any kind of dissent? What we're talking about here with a new synthesis or solid core with a lot of elasticity is not a game. It will be in a certain level, in a certain dimension, a lot of fun. But it's not a game. It'll be exhilarating on one level, in other words, but it'll also be extremely intense and require continually going back more and more deeply to our scientific approach to reality in order to be able to sort things out and handle them correctly. This is why some of these intellectuals have said about what I'm putting forward, well, I believe you want to do that, but you're not going to be able to do it. And we have to prove them wrong on that, not because we want to be right and we want them to be wrong, but because we have to do this in order to get where we need to go. And at the same time, we have to overcome these, you know, historical and deeply rooted contradictions among the masses of people, in an ultimate and fundamental terms, between men and women, between intellectual and manual labor, even between different regions and parts of the country and the economy, with all their economic and social and cultural differences. This is all a very complex process, and you need a core of people who really deeply grasp and is continuing to deepen its grasp and to enlarge that core who grasps the whole scientific method and approach to dealing with all these contradictions. This can be extremely exhilarating, but it's also going to be extremely hair-raising. And we should understand that unity of opposites, and learn how to handle that well also. Another way of getting at this is that while we can't just leap to communism in a single bound, on the other hand, not just the final goal of communism, but the road to that goal all along the way, not just the idea or the ideal of communism, but the revolutionary process and the transition to communism must be and definitely can be, in reality, far better than the world as it is under this system. And that has to be a sort of a bedrock understanding of ours, not just so we can buck up our courage and not get demoralized, but this is a scientifically founded truth about reality. I was just talking to someone during the break here about another example they were bringing out about the horrific conditions of child labor. Some study that revealed that there's something like 200 million child laborers. He was telling me about people in India, kids, I should say, five-year-olds, making matches with all the sulfur all over them and reproduce that a million times over. This is the world that is, in fact, a horror for the great majority of humanity. And the reality of the struggle, as well as the final goal of communism, is and must be brought forward as something far better than that, even with all of its sacrifice struggle, even with all the upheaval, even with all the violence and destruction largely brought by the forces of the old order to prevent this radical transformation. And we face the challenge of not just overcoming the deep-seated social inequalities and the profound oppressive and exploitative relations in any particular country, this one included, but overcoming the whole lopsidedness in the world. Because for two reasons. One, most fundamentally, because that's what our whole struggle is all about, bringing a new world into being. And not simply creating a quote-unquote communist imperialism that feasts on the rest of the world in a different form, which wouldn't be communist at all, and would, in fact, be imperialist. And second of all, because unless and until all this lopsidedness is overcome and surpassed, it will not be possible to eliminate deep-seated social inequalities, profound relations of exploitation and oppression in any lasting way in any part of the world. The world is too interconnected and interknit to carve out in any long-term sense any part of the world that's somehow a zone free of all of that. That is all the more true today than it has ever been in history, and it underlines all the more the strategic importance and meaning of the fact that our orientation has to be one of proletarian internationalism and not something less than that in any form, not nationalism as our guiding outlook and as our orientation in any form. Even the nationalism of an oppressed people or oppressed nation can't take us where we need to go and can't uproot even national oppression in the world, let alone all the oppressive relations and profound social inequalities that still mark and mar the world. So overcoming the lopsidedness in the world is an essential and integral part of the revolution that we're all about. There will be no communism without that. And there will be no lasting rupture and profound enough rupture with those old property relations and old ideas. There will be no achieving of the four alls and then moving beyond that without doing it on a worldwide level and without in particular overcoming the great and even growing lopsidedness in the world. And this is not only a point of basic orientation, but it also adds to the complexity and, yes, to the difficulty of what we have to do. This is another key contradiction that from the beginning, even before we seized power, and then on a whole other level, once power is seized, now here and now there, we have to address consistently and systematically and handle in correct relationship to all the other contradictions that have to be dealt with. So this adds a whole other dimension to being drawn and quartered, or not being drawn and quartered, but going right up to the brink of it in order to do what needs to be done, which expresses the very real and acute tension that's involved if we're doing things correctly. Because there'll be a constant pull of people to want to just address very pressing problems that exist in the new socialist society itself for often very legitimate reasons, acute problems of feeding the people, of giving health care to the people, of providing decent housing for the people, of providing an education of the kind that would contribute to transforming the world and to enabling people to more deeply know and transform the world, of defending the particular socialist state here and there where it's created. And how to do all that without reinforcing, but working to overcome to the greatest degree possible at every point, this gigantic lopsidedness in the world adds a whole nother dimension. Now, I don't say all this from a point of view of, nor to foster and encourage pessimism. I firmly believe that there is a material basis for what we're setting out to do. And I believe along with that the more deeply one is grounded in materialism and in dialectics and actually understands the underlying and driving forces and contradictions and dynamics and what you're actually up against in all of its complexity, which we'll continue to learn more about in its concrete expression. But the more one grasps this in a sweeping way, the more possible it is to actually see the possibility of and move to bring into reality the kind of profound change we're talking about in the world. And the more one proceeds on the basis of either ignoring or being ignorant of these things, the more one is set up to be demoralized, because you're going to run into these things in the real world anyway. You know, you're not going to be able to go out in the real world and sidestep these contradictions, put them to the side and go ahead in a sort of a blindly optimistic way. You're going to have to work through these contradictions. And if you forget about them in their own way, the rest of the masses of people will remind you of them, which they do all the time. Yeah, but what about this? Yeah, but what about? They got all this. And yeah, but all these people around me are just caught up in all that, much of which is true, just looking at the surface and what's happening in any given time immediately around you. But what are the deeper and driving forces that are going to be shaping and influencing what people are confronting, beyond how they're seeing the world at a given time? Without understanding that, how can you see beyond all the shit that you have to come up against? Every time you turn around, there's another piece of backward shit you have to deal with. How are you going to see beyond that, beyond the surface of that, to the deeper underlying mainsprings and driving forces here that are going to shape how people are confronting reality as things further unfold, and they're going to present a different framework for people than the one that they're working out of? How many people in New Orleans a year and a half ago expected to be dealing with what they were dealing with when Katrina hit? I saw two HBO specials about gangs in New Orleans. One of the worst scenes of, you know, internal, you know, and particularly among black people in New Orleans, gang violence. And it's reasserting itself now. Of course, they're building it up, publicizing it, promoting it, fostering it, and then putting it all over the TV. But all of a sudden, in the context of this whole thing that developed with this hurricane, everything is very different. Not different in the fundamental way that we need to make it different, but very different. There's a whole different context. All that shit that people were doing on Tuesday doesn't have much meaning on Thursday, when you're trying to climb to your attic or to the top of your house to avoid being drowned. Well, there are bigger things than these hurricanes coming. And the way that massive people are confronted by reality and have to confront reality is going to keep changing. The imperialists don't have all freedom, and we don't have all necessity either. And so we have to learn how to deal with these contradictions, and you have to have a methodology and approach that enables you to keep digging down to the underlying and driving forces and to see correctly the interrelation of things and to see what is arising and coming onto the horizon even before it finds full expression, and to see what is a temporary phenomenon and what is a more significant and fundamental expression of something, and to be able to sort all those things out and handle correctly all the different relations. This is what's involved in leading the revolution that we need to lead. And we need and absolutely should not make any apologies about the fact that we need to lead it. Among different strata in society, there are different attitudes toward leadership. Among a lot of the petty bourgeoisie, with their illusions that nobody can ever tell them what to do, when they're being told every day by not only by political decision-making, but by the actual underlying dynamics of the system, they are caught up in a lot of illusions about this. And there's a spontaneous resistance to the idea of any kind of leadership. And it's been reinforced by a lot of relativism that's gone on been promoted over decades. Don't tell me what to do, and don't even tell me what to think, and don't tell me what's true and not true. Well, we can't do that and shouldn't do that in a crude form, but we do have to struggle with people about what's true and not true. But they have one, broadly speaking, there's one kind of attitude among those strata, and there's another kind among more basic masses, which is a certain sense that if you get any good leaders, first of all, they'll probably sell you out, but if they don't, they'll just be crushed and killed. Well, we have to meet these challenges. But we have to do so from a scientific standpoint. We have to understand what the contradiction between a vanguard and the masses of people, which is a real contradiction and does hold the potential to be turned into its opposite, into something negative. But what is that rooted in? What are the underlying contradictions that take form and shape as a contradiction between the masses and a vanguard? And on the other hand, what is the correct way to, or at the same time, what is the correct way to handle that contradiction? What are the needs of the masses of people? Do they need a vanguard or don't they? It's just that simple. How do we answer that question scientifically? That's what Lenin was addressing, among other things, in What Is to Be Done. It's why a lot of these petty bourgeois Democrats hate What Is to Be Done, because Lenin was speaking profoundly in a scientific way to the need for a leadership that a lot of these petty bourgeois forces spontaneously don't want to see exercised. Which, again, doesn't mean that they should be cast into the camp of the enemy, but it's another contradiction we have to work our way through correctly, right up to the brink of being drawn and quartered without actually being drawn and quartered, and repeatedly. But we should never lose sight of the fact that the masses of people have no way out of this other than through taking up this ideology and other than through the leadership of a vanguard. And if we forget that, and if we go away from that, even in the name of the masses, it will be the most profound betrayal of the masses of people, of the masses of humanity throughout the world who are suffering the daily horrors that we could sit here for the entire time we're here, speak about and never adequately describe. So if you step forward and recognize both the necessity and the possibility of this revolution, then the next step that you have to take, and it's one you have to repeatedly take, not only individually, but as part of a collective framework and within the context of collectively wrangling, is to actually go take hold firmly of this scientific outlook and method, and then continue to deepen that through the course of carrying it out in practice and in the dialectic back and forth in two expressions, between practice and theory, and in the relation between the vanguard and the masses. In order to eventually move beyond and through and overcome and surpass those contradictions and all the contradictions that are involved in this. So it's in this way that we can make it a reality that not just the final goal, but the road to that goal, not just the idea or somehow a utopian ideal of communism, but the revolutionary process and the transition to communism not only can be, but is in reality far better than the world as it is under this system. This is the way in which we go about bringing into being a new world and, yes, a new people in the world. People whose material conditions and whose outlook and motivations are radically different and radically better than what has ever existed before in the history of humanity. Something that's liberating for the great majority in every society and ultimately liberating for humanity as a whole. When we weigh this against even the most ideal expressions of bourgeois democracy, whether represented by Jefferson or others, we can see the complete poverty of even the ideal expressions of bourgeois democracy, and we can see the way in which not only the idea but the reality of communism and the struggle for communism is something going to a horizon far beyond that, that embodies and represents the struggle for a freedom, for an emancipation, for humanity that's in a whole other dimension than even the best of bourgeois democracy or anything else that has existed so far in human history. And as we see that, then we have to become more conscious and more consistent and in that way more determined in the struggle to lead the masses of people through all the contradictions to actually bring this into being.